From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George W. Bush came into office with the ouster of Saddam Hussein high on his agenda. Top military brass and diplomats have warned the president of many potential pitfalls in war on Iraq. But so far, a group of committed hawks with the president's ear and an itch for Baghdad continue to push America toward war. This hour, troops and consequences in Iraq. In a new Gallup poll out this week, 3 out of 5 Americans say they favor sending American troops back to the Gulf to remove Saddam Hussein from power. But a majority also say the U.S. should only use force if at least some Western allies agree to support the effort, and it's not at all clear that they would. I spoke with Jonathan Marcus earlier. He's defense correspondent for the BBC in London. I asked him if an attack on Iraq looks inevitable.
I think it looks inevitable in the sense of the rhetoric that is coming from the U.S. administration, a very clear position from the president, from his key advisors, that they want to see regime change in Iraq. I think what makes it less inevitable is, in a sense, they have no policy yet, no clearly formulated plan as to how to bring about that regime change. And I think a large measure of the skepticism that exists towards this idea in Europe is based on the fact that they clearly believe that the Americans do not have a clear idea as to how to set about this.
Does that make European leaders confident that at the end of the day, Washington will add up the operational obstacles and say, no, we simply can't do this?
Not necessarily. I think people are beginning abroad to listen to what the Bush administration and its spokesmen say rather more clearly. It isn't, I think, just rhetoric. I think they mean what they say, and I think they should be treated as serious people on that basis. I think what it does mean, and I think we've seen this already, is that if you remember a few weeks back, there almost seemed to be a steamroller building that some sort of war with Iraq was imminent. Then, if you like, the magnitude of the problems were realized. I think it became clear that at least some of the assets that are currently deployed in Afghanistan, not most importantly perhaps the unmanned aerial vehicles, the satellite cover and so on, that all of that would be needed if a serious military operation was to be waged against Iraq. So I think that, in a sense, has put it on the back burner for now. It's still very clearly a goal of the Bush administration, and I think clearly as planning continues, so other European allies will want to be having their say and will want to have a clear understanding of what the Bush administration wants. I think what's worrying people is that there does seem to be a growing sense of a new policy approach by the U.S. administration, all this talk of preemptive war, a policy that seems to put military measures perhaps before political and diplomatic ones. I think that is all causing unease in Europe, and I think they'll want to have a very clear sense of what America proposes regarding Iraq before they're going to come on board and support it.
You cover defense for the BBC. If the United States musters its resources and determines that it will go to war to change regimes in Iraq, do you have any doubt that the U.S. can win this war?
Well, I have no doubt in purely military terms that if America wanted to invade Iraq, it could do so. It would do so at a huge financial cost, one would hope, without a significant loss of life on any side. But I think there's no doubt that Iraq's military machine, for all the talk, is in a far worse state than it was at the time of the Gulf War. It's been starved of spares. Its air force has had only rudimentary training. Its air defense systems, whilst to some extent reconstituted, are clearly nothing like what they had before. And of course, in the meantime, as we've seen with the war in Afghanistan, America's military capabilities have advanced by leaps and bounds. We're seeing the first tantalizing signs of this new form of warfare that many of these information systems have promised. I think the problem lies elsewhere. There's no doubt we don't have a strategy. We don't know whether this would be Desert Storm Mark II, whether it would be some other variant of the sort of campaign we've seen in Afghanistan. The real problems lie in what comes next. I think there's no clear understanding of who would rule Iraq. There doesn't seem to be much of an opposition as there was in Afghanistan on which you can build. The opposition is in Iraq is unimpressive at best. Saddam Hussein seems to have killed anybody who would really stand seriously against him. So I think it's those questions of what comes next rather than the pure military costs of any campaign that are the ones that the Americans will have to answer if they're to convince some of their allies to come on board.
And does the uncertainty over what would follow Saddam Hussein outweigh, in the European mind, the danger of weapons of mass destruction that we are repeatedly told Saddam Hussein continues to develop?
Possibly for the moment it does. I think there is concern about weapons of mass destruction amongst European governments. There are clearly, the world isn't seen in quite the same stark terms as seen in Washington. Clearly, the events of September the 11th for Americans encouraged them to have a very different view of things. To be fair, this was a policy that the Bush administration was developing well before September the 11th. President Bush has clearly identified weapons of mass destruction in the hands of so-called rogue states as being part and parcel of this whole problem of international terrorism, and he's viewing it very much through that prism. I don't think the Europeans yet view it in quite the same terms. They're concerned about weapons of mass destruction, certainly. They are, I suppose, in some senses, even closer than America is to some of the main missile threats. But I think, nonetheless, whilst there's talk, you know, here within NATO of missile defense, of planning some sorts of limited defensive systems for ourselves, I think there is a skepticism. I think there's a feeling that the old policies of containment, of deterrence, and so on, still have some role to play.
If the United States stands up, embraces this new view of the world, and goes to war with Iraq, will European allies join in the effort?
Clearly, one fundamental question is what immediate justification the Americans are going to have. This rather vague and woolly notion of preemptive war, I think, needs to be fleshed out much more. I think also the Americans have to flesh out much more how they are going to bring their allies on board. If you're going to have this recipe of preemptive military action, just who is going to be involved? Is it going to be the United Nations? One assumes not. Is it going to be some concert of the major powers and America's major allies? Well, that might be more likely. But I think clearly the Americans can't just go it alone. For one thing, any post-conflict resolution is presumably going to require wider support. It's going to require wider economic assistance and so on. And I'm not entirely sure that it is really in the realms of possibility to simply remove people from power without having any clear sense of whether what's going to replace them is in the long term going to be any better. I mean, the likelihood is that whoever would replace Saddam Hussein in Iraq would probably be just as nasty, just as unpleasant, whether they'd be rather more pro-Western or not, or more willing to give up weapons of mass destruction, who knows?
Jonathan Marcus, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Marcus is defense correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with me earlier from London. Technically, President Bush has a big public decision to make. Is it time now, after years of threats and sanctions and cruise missiles, to go to war and take out Saddam Hussein? In practice, the decision seems to be all but made. Bush's advisers are split. On one side stand the hesitators, warning that war on Iraq, pursued in the wrong way or at the wrong time or perhaps at all, could spell disaster. But on the other side is a powerful group of conservative think tank scholars and defense policy intellectuals who are pushing to take Saddam out, pushing for war. People like Richard Perle, defense advisor to Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. People like Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. These gung-ho voices and their tough view of the world appear to be winning, perhaps to have won the debate. The conventional wisdom in much of Washington today, war on Iraq is coming. It's only a matter of when. Do you feel confident in the people most closely advising President Bush on this issue? Whose advice means the most to you? And are you ready for whatever it may take to remove Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Joshua Marshall. He's an independent writer and formerly Washington editor of the American Prospect magazine. His article, Bomb Saddam, is in the current issue of the Washington Monthly. Good evening and welcome, Joshua Marshall.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Josh Marshall, you have outlined with a really terrific clarity the sides in the debate over war on Iraq. You point out that this is an agenda that the Bush administration came into office with, that 9/11 has not really pushed it off the rails. Give us the sides here. I guess first, what's the heart of the debate and how do the sides line up? Who's on either side?
Well, this is basically a debate, if you look at it in institutional terms within the executive branch, a debate between the Department of Defense on one side and the State Department on the other. Now, on those two sides, you have some players that wouldn't be immediately obvious. For instance, the office of the vice president, basically Dick Cheney's shop at the White House mm-hmm. and the old executive office building, is very much on the Defense Department side of this. And the CIA, for instance, tends to be on the State Department side of this.
Who's for what?
Basically, the State Department just is not crazy about doing this. Some of them think the whole idea is crazy.
Of war with Iraq, or an invasion,
right,
that is.
Right. Others just think that the people who seem to have the president's ear are crazy and are not the ones that you would want to actually be running such a war.
When you say the Defense Department, I guess you're suggesting they're more in favor of, but does that include the generals?
Well, that's the thing. They're in this Defense Department, the Bush Defense Department, the Bush Pentagon, there's a very big difference. You have, on the civilian side, a number of defense intellectuals, very ideological, very hawkish, and in some ways fairly dismissive of the uniformed military. Not in the sense that some people thought the Clinton administration was from some sort of countercultural perspective, mm-hmm. but they often look at the people in uniform as sort of, you know, bureaucratic fuddy-duddies who don't know all the cutting-edge ideas about how to fight modern wars. Mm-hmm. So the people on the civilian side, basically in the office of the Secretary of Defense, are very gung-ho on this, very much want to do it soon, think it can be done much more easily than the people in uniform do, and also think that you might be able to do it through a mix of, you know, cutting-edge technology, sort of the way that it was done in Afghanistan.
Relatively cheap and boldly at low cost in troops.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly.
It's a fascinating coterie that you describe that are pushing this idea. Tell us about the men, and I guess it's mainly men, who are pushing it, and their background and their record.
Well, the godfather of all these hawks is Richard Perle. And he was in the Reagan administration. He has been at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a key conservative think tank in D.C. He's now on something called the Defense Policy Board at the Pentagon, which is sort of an informal advisory board there, which he has made a lot more powerful than it was in the past. He's closely associated with Paul Wolfowitz, who you mentioned before, mm-hmm. who's Deputy Secretary of Defense. These two men have proteges that they have been cultivating going back two decades, and lots of these men, and it is mainly men, although certainly not all, got appointments in this administration, a lot of them at the Pentagon. There are some at the State Department, there are some at various NSC and White House roles, but these two men, again, Perle and Wolfowitz, had a lot of luck on really stacking the deck with people who agreed with them.
You call them hawks, and I guess that's in an old-fashioned sense that means ready to use the military option to achieve policy aims.
Yes, leaning much more towards force than diplomacy. They were very much both hawks in the Cold War context, very associated with the Reagan buildup. In the context of the politics of the Middle East, they are both very pro-Israel, and even with Perle has close links with the Likud in Israel, and definitely sees the region in, I would say, fairly polarized terms.
So not just pro-Israel, but pro the conservative faction in Israel.
Correct. And I think they definitely the way that this fight really has played out over the last several decades is that the sort of the old school, for lack of a better word, at the State Department and the CIA, a lot of them be considered Arabists, have come from a certain view of the politics of the Middle East, which would be much more favorable to a number of the Arab, what we would call Arab moderate regimes. Mm-hmm. Wolfowitz and Perle see that as a discredited viewpoint, and because of that, they see much of the bureaucratic cadre at the State Department, at the CIA, as discredited themselves.
They're ready to roll. Josh Marshall, we've got to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about the fascinating history of these guys. You'll remind us of it. Listeners, are you aware that America continues to move toward war with Iraq? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about war and Iraq tonight. Are you aware that America continues to move toward war with Iraq? Who do you want owning the president's ear on war with Iraq? Colin Powell, the Joint Chiefs, the political hawks who helped Ronald Reagan tear down the Soviet Union. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Josh Miller. His author in the Washington Monthly is entitled Bomb Saddam. And Josh Miller, give us the historical context for this. We know it, but not quite, I'm not sure we always see the connections between the history of the last couple decades that we remember and what's going on right now. This the Pearl Wolfowitz axis, if you want to call it that, has been involved in key decisions on American posture toward the world ever since the Reagan years. Give us the quick highlights of where their view has been powerful and won and been successful, and where it hasn't been so successful.
Well, there's still this ongoing debate about just how much America's actions had to do with how the Cold War ended, the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and into the early 90s. Certainly, many conservatives would say that these men pushed Ronald Reagan to take a very hard line against the Soviet Union and that that contributed in some way to the collapse of the Soviet Union. That's really still a matter of debate.
But they would claim it as a scalp on the belt.
They certainly would. And another very key historical event for these people and their opponents in the government is the Gulf War itself. Many of the people at the State Department, mm-hmm. the sort of the traditional experts on the region, said that our attack on Iraq in 1990-91 would inflame the region, our friends would be overthrown, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't quite that clear cut, but there was a lot of hand-wringing about what might happen. And of course, it didn't turn out that way. Our friends were not overthrown. And this is basically what the hawks were saying. They said it's we're going to go in there. It will not be as difficult as you say, and our allies will all be there.
And we'll win. And more than that, they wanted to roll on Baghdad. Were ultimately frustrated in that when George Bush's father turned to the more conservative elements. You say.
Yeah. I think there's some retrospective. Changing of minds here. Not everybody. Mm-hmm. A lot of people thought that there was no way that Saddam Hussein could survive the political aftermath of that war. But yeah, they did want to go, and they wanted to do it in a complete fashion.
So there's a little "we told you so" going on here.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of sense of vindication on several counts.
What about fronts on which they pushed for hawkish action that didn't work out so well?
Well, where to start? I think these are the same people who involved the country in a lot of the peripheral conflicts of the Cold War,
such as
Central America in the early 80s, in Nicaragua and El Salvador, in Africa, in the 70s and 80s. A lot of the, again, peripheral conflicts of the Cold War where we destabilized regions, mm-hmm. at least had some part in leading to the deaths of many people. They are still the same people by and large who are still obsessed with Cuba, even though, most people privately at least will say, what on earth are we doing with this embargo against Cuba? Mm-hmm. This is the past, et cetera, despite the fact that people still vote for it, et cetera.
Some losses on the belt of history here. And now it's Iraq in the gun sights of this group, and they appear to have very good access to the ear of George W. Bush. Josh Marshall, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Michael O'Hanlon. He's senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, author of several books, including Defense Policy Choices for the Bush Administration, 2000 to 2005. Good evening and welcome, Michael O'Hanlon.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you back. Michael, there is a lot of talk about the move toward a war with Iraq pushing ahead, almost silently ahead, I think, to many Americans' ears. How do you size up the debate in Washington right now? Do you think that the pro-war faction is winning?
It's a funny place where we are in this debate right now, Tom, because on the one hand, you have the huge conflagration in the Middle East between the Palestinians and the Israelis mm-hmm. that makes it very hard to really pursue this option right now, because we don't have a lot of Arab countries that would be very happy about cooperating with us at this moment. They're going to want to see some progress on that front before they are willing to face down their own publics and go along with this campaign to overthrow Saddam that most of them do not feel any great need to be part of. Mm-hmm. We can probably twist their arms, but these may not be the best times to do that. And then secondly, there's this ongoing debate within the United States itself about what it would take to overthrow Saddam. And people point to the Afghanistan model of warfare and say, listen, modern air power is so good. You stick a few special forces on the ground, you drop some of these precision bombs, you work with the Iraqi opposition, you can overthrow Saddam without really any serious military effort.
And this is the Richard Pearl view. We've heard him articulated on this show.
That's right. And I actually find his prediction ultimately has some slight chance of being correct. But his policy prescription, I think, is simply not acceptable, because you cannot try this option, fail, and then have no backup plan. That's the sort of thing that people were critical of the Clinton administration for doing in Kosovo for a while. That's the sort of thing that would leave our regional allies livid with us if we simply help foster insurrection on the edges of Iraq without having any definitive effect on Saddam, and just angering him and leading him to look for ways to strike out against
him. So is this not where the edge of the debate seems to have come at this point, whether you just go in cheap and bold and hope that a quick strike will somehow turn the chemistry of the Iraqi military against Saddam and you take him out? Or on the other hand, if I read Josh Marshall correctly, he's saying the generals say, if you're going to try this, and it looks like perhaps we will, we've got to have a major military force ready to go in, invasion style, if the quick hit doesn't work. Michael O'Hanlon, is that a fair analysis?
Yes, it is, Tom. And I personally agree with the generals, not just because they're generals, but because if you look at what modern air power can do, and you look at what it might be able to do inside of a city, it's a lot harder to use it there than in the open desert. And so when we attacked the Taliban in their trench lines in Afghanistan, out in the open of the desert, that was one thing. But to start using these precision strike weapons inside of Baghdad, where Saddam would probably hole up along mm-hmm. with his top protectors, is unlikely to work. And if you want the Iraqi military to splinter and ultimately change sides, which they may do, you've got to convince them that Saddam's defeat is inevitable. And the only way to do that is to put in the large force. So, ironically, if what you're trying to do is to minimize the amount of fighting you have to do, you want to go in big and strong, intimidate the Iraqi army, and try to get them to change sides as quickly as possible. But if you just drop bombs on them, you know, they're used to getting American bombs dropped on them. We've been doing it nonstop for about 11 years. They know how to hide their equipment, and I don't think it'll work.
But this debate, then, moves the whole question away from whether or not there should be war to how it should be done, quick and bold or on a more major scale. Does it not, Josh Marshall?
That's true. And I think one of the reasons that's the case is that we've been at this for about a decade now, and everybody is basically has bought into a series of assumptions which at this point make some sort of aggressive action almost inevitable. And so there really is a debate, should be a debate, about whether those assumptions are correct. I happen to think they are. But again, politically speaking, both parties have completely bought into those series of assumptions, and they've sort of played themselves out to this point. Now that inspectors are gone, now that he is sort of reconstituting to some degree his military strength, now that he's getting more oil revenues, the whole matter has been brought to a head. And I think that's why the debate has sort of silently shifted so much towards a war footing.
Michael O'Hanlon, do you agree? Has the debate really, are we not talking about whether or not it's a good idea now, but simply talking about whether it's light military or heavy military?
Yeah, I think Josh is right about the way the conversation's playing out in Washington right now. However, I'm not persuaded we're actually going to do this because, everyone's against Saddam. I mean, who can be for Saddam? And every American politician going back to the Gulf War has wanted Saddam to be replaced. You alluded to the fact that we all thought it might happen almost of Saddam's own weight, just falling because of the opposition after the Gulf War. And so it's easy to say, yeah, I want a new regime in Baghdad, and yeah, I'll help the Iraqi opposition. And everyone's been tempted to do that. But, you mentioned Colin Powell being a part of this debate earlier. And what Colin Powell is most famous for in American military history is saying that if you're going to do something, do it right. do it with enough force to assure yourself a victory. Don't play around with the use of force. And as long as he is in this administration, I ultimately am not sure that they're going to be willing to just sort of play around with a little bit of air power and a few arms for the Iraqi opposition, because it probably won't work. Even if it might work, there's a very good chance it won't, and what do you do then? So in the end, I think President Bush has not focused squarely enough on this problem. I don't think he's made any real decisions, and I think when Colin Powell and others really force him to face squarely what it would take to win, he may ultimately not do it. I don't think it is a foregone conclusion.
And yet we feel this kind of subterranean momentum. It's a strange thing. Listeners, how public, how open should the debate over war with Iraq be? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question. This is a very complicated and messy situation, but one of the things that makes it really scary is how difficult it is to anticipate the potential for kind of a doomsday bioterrorism response.
On the United States by Iraq, do you mean?
Yes, against the United States and allies or other countries in the region. And, one question is, how do we, anticipate that and prevent it from happening? And can we even have that debate in public, or does it have to take place almost in secret because the techniques, the things you'd need to know and the techniques you'd need to use to do it, discussing them in some ways undermines their value, their strategic value. I mean,
it could give ideas to Baghdad, though they seem to have very fertile minds on that front. But, John, does that suggest to you that the United States should go in and take these weapons out, perhaps even at the cost of war, or that it's unwise even to consider that kind of approach?
I think it may be necessary, but I'm not confident at the quality of the debate, at least what we're hearing in public,
mm-hmm.
unless there's a private debate going on that is considerably more sophisticated than what we're hearing. I'm not sure that we're going to be adequately prepared for the actual risks involved.
John, thank you for your call. Michael O'Hanlon, John raises the concern about a counterattack on the United States mainland by Iraq, maybe even bioterror. Is that part of the equation here as the United States weighs the possibility of war with Iraq?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question to raise. There are a number of dimensions to it. First of all, are the chances that Iraq would do this greater if you sort of let Saddam be or if you tell him that you're coming to overthrow him?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a good chance that the chances would be higher in the second scenario, but we obviously need to weigh the pros and cons. Another concern is then to say, well, if Iraq wanted to do this, how effective would Iraq probably be? And the good news on this front is that most of the Iraqi intelligence apparatus has spent the last 10 years trying to buy banned technology overseas so they can make weapons at home. They have not been, as far as we know, casing American cities and military facilities around the world. They have not done the same thing that Iran and Hezbollah have done, which do go around and try to identify potential targets and plan attacks in advance. So if Iraq tried to do this, I think they would have some success, but probably not overwhelming success. In other words, it may be the sort of thing that you have to factor in, you have to worry about, you certainly consider a cost of war or a risk of war. I don't think it's reason enough to call off the idea, but it certainly is a real concern, and I'm delighted that John raised it, because there is no more sophisticated debate in Washington that's happening on this front. I'm pretty confident that people like him need to weigh in, because we're not hearing that kind of concern right now.
And I know we've got to lose you in just a few seconds, but I guess bottom line, if this is a debate with battle lines drawn, where do you come out, Michael O'Hanlon? Is military intervention necessary, as we often hear, to remove the threat that Saddam Hussein presents?
My judgment is that it's not necessary. My judgment is that we have Saddam contained, and the evidence of the last 10 years suggests that he may occasionally try to break out of his box, but he won't do anything too drastic. That's my overall judgment. However, I respect very much the views of those who say, listen, it really would be better not to test that theory, not to let Saddam keep making progress towards a nuclear weapon. And so I understand the case for overthrow, and I think it's a serious case. I don't make that argument myself,
mm-hmm.
but my only bottom line is, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's not delude ourselves into thinking the Afghanistan model is going to work. This requires, to be confident it's going to work, it requires you to get ready for Desert Storm 2. Not quite as big of a war, but possibly a somewhat bloodier war, because we could have to fight in the streets of Baghdad, possibly against chemical weapons used by Iraqi forces. I don't think they'll fight that well. I don't think they'll fight that long, but I do think they may fight a while, and I think we better be ready for real war if we're going to do this.
Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon is Senior Fellow fellow in the foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Josh Marshall, you heard there Michael O'Hanlon say he's not sure, despite all the push, despite how the hawks have President Bush's ear, that ultimately Washington will actually go through with this. How far down the road are we here, and do you agree that there's that real possibility of a pullback?
I certainly think there's that possibility. I think that the sort of the cogs of war have advanced more than most people in D.C. think, though, or maybe most people in the country. I think it's certainly possible this might not happen. It's possible that the president might draw back. But I certainly think it's much more likely than not that it will happen.
We hear military people saying that they're already actively preparing for this war, armoring choppers and requisitioning supplies, the kind of supplies that would be required to go into Iraq. Is it possible that whether or not they support the idea, that the generals under Donald Rumsfeld's direction are preparing for it because they may be ordered to do it?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that they're preparing for it. They're preparing for it in terms of moving various assets into the area, and that's both troops and pre-positioned weapons and stuff like that. And if you watch the newspapers closely, you'll see hints of this. It's you know, this isn't a matter of moving, at least at this point, you know, 500,000 soldiers. So it's not something that gets huge headlines, but things are being done, and there's no question that preparations are being made. Now, obviously, to a certain degree, you just want to make those preparations to have as wide a range of options as possible should the decision be made. But I have no question that preparations are being made on various fronts.
Michael O'Hanlon's saying he doesn't necessarily support it, but if we do it, we should do it right. What will doing it right mean in terms of men and or troops and materiel?
I think most of the high-level you know, career military officers at the Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs, et cetera, would say that you need about 250,000 troops in the area. And that's obviously not nearly as many as we had during the Gulf War, but it's quite a few.
What did we have during the Gulf War? Remind us.
I believe about 500,000.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So maybe a quarter million. It's still a lot of troops.
Right. And basically do it the way, on a slightly smaller scale, the way we did then. Have all of our forces at the ready. There's some question about the, again, it's important to say some say as few as a little under 200,000, mm-hmm. or, you know, around that area. But basically to have kind of all of our, you know, all of our assets at the ready when we do this. And I think that, I think the way this debate has been framed, a lot of people portray it as that the military is just against this altogether. There's actually even divisions within the uniformed services. Mm. I think that there are a lot of people and when I say army, sometimes I'm speaking loosely, I just mean the military, people in the military who think this is a good idea, but they have a real concern that it is that the civilians of the Pentagon are either going to want to do it on the cheap, mm-hmm. or that they're getting them being the army or them being the military into this without any sort of serious public debate. And I have spoken to some of these people, and their feeling is like, you know, this could be very bloody, very ugly affair.
Well, we're stoking that debate right now. Listeners, should the U.S. strike quickly at Saddam and hope his grip crumbles? Should it mass troops at the border and swamp Baghdad? Should it not go in at all? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about war and Iraq. Listeners, if a war with Iraq comes, and the odds seem very good that it well may, whether it's in 6 months or 18 months, are you confident of a U.S. victory at a reasonable price? And what Middle East do you see on the other side of war with Iraq? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Josh Marshall. He's author of the article entitled Bomb Saddam in the June issue of the Washington Monthly. And we're joined on the line now by Peter. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
I'd like to take issue with something Jonathan Marcus said, saying one has no idea whether what follows Saddam Hussein will be maybe just as bad.
This is Jonathan Marcus, the BBC correspondent we spoke to at the top of the hour.
He said that, and I certainly have no way of knowing why he says that. First of all, I could hardly imagine anyone worse, but But the whole point is not really just to eliminate this particular man, mm-hmm. but to seize control of the weaponry that he has been of all sorts that he has been producing, make sure that whoever succeeds him doesn't possess that weaponry, make sure it doesn't get to other countries mm-hmm. or groups or grouplets, and that clearly is, you know, a government that did not worry about that kind of weaponry in the hands of people who, for a number of reasons, some of which I believe are immutable.
So, Peter, it sounds to me as though you're saying, yes, maybe we have to go in because these weapons are there or coming and they're dangerous, and this is the George Bush line.
Well, I think that any weapons that are likely to be those called of mass destruction should not be in the hands of any regimes that are likely to have people who either use them or pass them off or allow them to be captured or taken by not just states but groups that do not wish us well. I think mm-hmm. any government that did not do something about this would be criminally negligent, and I would be absolutely horrified if the American government did not do something.
Peter, we got it, and thank you for your call. Josh Marshall, what about the post-war view? I guess let's look at specifically what the hawks, as you call them, imagine on the other side of war with Iraq. You describe it as a kind of almost shock therapy that they see this war as bringing to the entire Middle East.
Yeah, they have a very grand plan about how this will all shake out, and it is basically that we invade Iraq. We install some sort of democratic government. The rest of the people in the Middle East see what a good deal this is, and this leads to a slow or maybe fast spread of democracy to various other countries in the region.
And on top of that, more regime change in other countries?
More regime change in a democratic direction. And I think they would add to that the example of how powerful the U.S. is would probably lead people to treat us with even more respect. And I suspect in the short term that's almost definitely true at some level.
But that's a real region-wide shakeup that they're envisioning here then. It sounds like turmoil before you get to the promised land.
Yeah, it's I don't think it's too much to say that it's a rather fanciful vision. And I think one of the great weaknesses of the hawks is that they see certain trends in very broad outlines accurately, but often have a very unrealistic sense of how they will actually happen in the short term. And I think the best argument of people who oppose this military involvement, going to war against Iraq, is to say precisely that. You know, fine, you go into Iraq, you take over, you kill or capture Saddam Hussein, you get the weapons, and then what? Now you're right in the center of the Middle East. You've got Iran on one side, you've got Saudi Arabia on the other, you've got Syria up to the north, you know, to the west and the north or whatever. What do you do then? What do you do? How unhappy is the population? That's a really serious question.
But the hawks are not daunted by this. We know Richard Pearl says they'll throw off their burqas like Afghans and be delighted. Josh, let me get another call in here. Ali is on the line. Welcome, Ali. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a quick question for you, and that is if has this point of maybe Al-Qaeda or even Iraq may use this to widen the conflict, whether between the Islamic world and or possibly by engaging into some sort of a war with Israel.
You mean Al-Qaeda and maybe even Iraq might welcome this conflict?
Well, not welcome, but they just like how United States getting ready, you know, getting the soldiers through the training, maybe the opposition is also doing the same thing. They're also getting ready, possibly targeting certain places in the United States or perhaps instigating with Israel to get the war even more.
We got it. Ali, thank you for the call. Josh Marshall, how about this? You know, we have heard Al-Qaeda say almost, bring it on. We want the big conflict. In a way, sometimes they almost seem to mirror the U.S. hawks.
I think that's right. I think I can pretty much guarantee you that Iraq is not saying bring this on. That they really don't want this to happen. I don't think there's any question about that. Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalists more you know, violent Islamic fundamentalists more generally, since obviously they don't have a state per se, they don't have assets to protect in the same way, I think that there is certainly an element within that group that would like this to happen, in the sense that it would, for many, make the bring the conflict between the so-called conflict between the West and the Islamic world into even sharper relief.
So they have very different goals, but their sense of what might transpire on the other side is not what Washington would like to see.
Certainly not. Certainly not. I mean, I think that there are people in Al-Qaeda who see the aftermath of this kind of war in at least somewhat similar terms to what people at the State Department see as the aftermath. And that would be a lot of really, really angry people on the borders, arrest of population, us being there and not knowing just when we're going to be able to get out, and just a huge mess. And maybe, you know, the Saudi government falls or the Egyptian government falls and all sorts of terrible stuff.
Josh Marshall, got 20 seconds left. What should American citizens be looking for to have an understanding of whether or not this is rolling ahead toward plan?
I would frankly just assume that it is. I think that is a very good assumption, and I think for people to find out whether this makes sense, I think find out about the weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq, and just how much we can sort of let that risk play itself out, or whether we have to take actions in our own hands now.
Joshua Marshall, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Marshall is author of Bomb Saddam in the current issue of the Washington Monthly. He's editor of Talking Points Memo. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, On Point's audio archaeologist looks at the birth of the jazz organ. This is On Point. In the early 20th century, most Americans associated the organ with church music, but in 1926, a young Thomas Fats Waller, then making a name for himself as a New Orleans pianist, tried out some jazz tunes on the organ. Some enterprising businessmen recorded Waller's playing and stumbled upon the genesis of jazz organ. Tonight, On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors takes a look at the early days of jazz organ and the genius of Fats Waller.
In the autumn of 1926, the Victor Talking Machine Company brought a group of singers to a deconsecrated church in Camden, New Jersey. Eldridge Johnson, the founder of the company, bought the Trinity Church a few years earlier and outfitted it as a remote recording studio. He liked the acoustics of the place, and he refurbished the old 2,000-pipe church organ. The singers were there to record a spiritual, All God's Chilling Got Wings, and the accompanist was 23-year-old Thomas Fats Waller, who'd been playing the pipe organ in theaters since his teens. The spiritual itself was never released, but as a warm-up for the session, he began playing W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. The sound engineers liked it and captured it on wax. This was the first of a number of Fats Waller's solo jazz recordings for the organ. Here's Fats Waller at Trinity Church in 1927. Had the benefit of microphones for this performance. But organ recordings of any kind were rare before the mid-1920s because of the difficulty of recording an instrument of such physical power and range. They weren't exactly portable, and acoustic recordings before 1925 could only reproduce a range of about 2.5 octaves, less than 10% of the tonal range of the pipe organ. There were no microphones. The master disc was cut from a recording horn. Despite a general lack of enthusiasm for recording what Mozart called a king of instruments, some record companies tried. Here's an acoustical recording of Milton Thomas in 1924 playing Through the Shady Lane on the Great Wurlitzer at the Tivoli Theater in Chicago. There was a blizzard of advertising hype in the fall of 1925. Victor announced to the world that a new era in recorded sound had arrived. But unlike most hype, they were right. They had secured the rights to an electrical recording process that came from the labs of Western Electric, and the results were stunning. The stilted, limited tonal range of acoustical recordings had been expanded dramatically. Surface noise was diminished, and for the first time, the sounds of the tuba and the bass were evident, and the upper register tones had the overtone coloration that earlier listeners could only imagine. With this new sonic palette, the sound engineers of the time wanted to try everything. In 1929, HMV, the British branch of Victor, set up a microphone in a London hall and recorded Arthur Miele's popular composition for pipe organ, Storm, his organ interpretation of the drama of a thunderstorm. Back on this side of the Atlantic, Victor invited the Louisiana Sugar Babes to the Trinity Church, a quartet that toured in those years with the musical Keep Shufflin'. James P. Johnson played piano, Jabbo Smith was on cornet, Garvin Bushell played clarinet, and Fats Waller sat at the pipe organ. The art of sound mixing and microphone placement was in its infancy, and this session presented the challenge of balancing the power of the organ with the other three instruments. Here in Rodgers and Hart's Thou Swell, Waller shows his genius, restraint, and great humor, pulling in and out of the arrangement and managing to mix jazz with irresistible theatrical flourishes. Of pipe organ jazz was a short one. Lawrence Hammond had been playing around with the idea of a fully electronic organ since the early 30s and was manufacturing them by 1934. They were portable, at least compared to the pipe organ, and perfect for studio work. One of the first artists to really take to this instrument was Milt Hirth, a factory timekeeper in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who got his first lessons in theater organ from a Hindu organist and went on to record for Decca with a trio. He sat down at a Hammond organ in 1939 and recorded Church Mouse on a Spree. Waller may have been the first to play jazz on the organ, but the architect of the sound that we've come to associate with the jazz organ was Wild Bill Davis. In 1946, he was working with Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five. Here in Tamburica Boogie, a tribute to, of all things, a Croatian folk instrument, Davis introduced the swelling rhythmic style that would come to define jazz organ in the post-war years. Let's close with another visit to Trinity Church in Camden, New Jersey. Here's Fats Waller in 1927 playing solo pipe organ on Hog Maw Stomp.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sabib Mir, Samantha Sodikson, and Chris Bonacci. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by...